Chapter 88. Berlin. Overall, Josef Goebbels felt content about the way the war was going. As best he could tell, morale in England was slipping. A big air raid on Plymouth was reported to have caused outright panic. "The effect is devastating," Goebbels wrote in his diary. "Secret reports from London tell of a collapse of morale, principally caused by our air raids." In Greece, he wrote, "the English are in full flight." Best of all, Churchill himself appeared to be growing increasingly pessimistic. He is said to be in a very depressed state, spending the entire day smoking and drinking. Goebbels wrote in his diary, "This is the kind of enemy we need." His diary crackled with enthusiasm for the war and for life. "What a glorious spring day outside," he wrote. "How beautiful the world can be, and we have no chance to enjoy it. Human beings are so stupid. Life is so short, and they then go and make it so hard for themselves." Chapter 89. This Scowling Valley. On April 24th and 25th, 17,000 British troops fled Greece. The next night, another 19,000 also evacuated. In Egypt, Rommel's tanks continued their advance. Within England, concern grew that maybe Britain was incapable of taking the offensive and holding territory gained. This was the third major evacuation since Churchill had become Prime Minister. First Norway, then Dunkirk, now Greece. "That's all we're really good at," sniped Alexander Cadogan in his diary. Sensing that the latest military setbacks might be rattling the public and the United States, Churchill made a broadcast on Sunday night, April 27th, from Chequers. He framed his recent visits to bomb-damaged cities as having been conducted expressly to gauge the national sentiment. "I have come back not only reassured, but refreshed," he said. He reported that popular morale was high. "Indeed," he said, "I felt encompassed by an exaltation of spirit in the people which seemed to lift mankind and its troubles above the level of material facts into that joyous serenity we think belongs to a better world than this." Here he may have laid it on a bit too thick. His statement that morale was best in the worst bombed areas took some swallowing, wrote one mass observation diarist from his hospital bed. He heard another patient say, "You liar." Churchill told his listeners that he felt a deep responsibility to bring them safely out of this long, stern, scowling valley, and offered cause for optimism. "There are less than 70 million malignant Huns, some of whom are curable and others killable," he said. Meanwhile, he pointed out, "The peoples of the British Empire and of the United States number nearly 200 million in their homelands and in the British dominions alone. They have more wealth, more technical resources, and they make more steel than the whole of the rest of the world put together." He urged his audience not to lose its sense of proportion and thus become discouraged or alarmed. Though happy with the speech, Churchill understood that he could not afford further setbacks, especially in the Middle East, where success had once gleamed so brightly. In a most secret directive to his war cabinet on Monday, April 28th, he demanded that all ranks recognize that the life and honor of Great Britain depends upon the successful defense of Egypt. All precautionary plans that contemplated the evacuation of Egypt or the scuttling of the Suez Canal were to be withdrawn from circulation immediately and locked away, with access closely controlled. "No whisper of such plans is to be allowed," he wrote. "No surrenders by officers and men will be considered tolerable, unless at least 50% casualties are sustained by the unit or force in question. Any general or staff officer who found himself facing imminent capture by the enemy was to shoot it out with his pistol. The honor of a wounded man is safe," he wrote. "Anyone who can kill a Hun, or even an Italian, has rendered good service." As always, one of his prime concerns was how Roosevelt would perceive further foundering. "The failure to win the Battle of Egypt would be a disaster of the first magnitude to Great Britain," Churchill wrote on Wednesday, April 30th, in a minute addressed to Pug Ismay, Lord Beaverbrook, and senior Admiralty officials. "It might well determine the decisions of Turkey, Spain, and Vichy. It might strike the United States the wrong way. That is, they might think we are no good." But America wasn't his only problem. His broadcast did little to cool the discontent that simmered among his opponents, chief among them Lloyd George, who would soon have an opportunity to express that opposition. On Tuesday, April 29th, Hastings Lees Smith, acting chair of the Parliamentary Labour Party, invoked Parliament's private notice provision to place a question immediately before Churchill asking when a debate on the war situation will take place. Churchill replied that not only would he schedule a debate, he would invite the Commons to vote on a resolution. That this House approves the policy of His Majesty's government in sending help to Greece and declares its confidence that our operations in the Middle East and in all other theatres of war will be pursued by the government with the utmost vigour. It would, of course, constitute a referendum on Churchill himself. The timing struck some as symbolic, if not ominous, with the debate set to occur exactly 1 year after the vote that unseated former Prime Minister Chamberlain and brought Churchill to power. In Berlin, Joseph Goebbels contemplated the motivation behind Churchill's broadcast and its potential effect. He kept careful watch on the evolving relationship between America and Britain, weighing how his propagandists might best influence the outcome. The battle over intervention or non-intervention continues to rage in the USA, he wrote in his diary on Monday, April 28th, the day after the broadcast. The outcome was hard to predict. We are active to the best of our ability, but we can scarcely make ourselves heard against the deafening Jew chorus. In London they are placing all their last hopes in the USA. If something does not happen soon, then London is faced with annihilation. Goebbels sensed mounting anxiety. Their great fear is of a knockout blow during the next weeks and months. We should do our best to justify these fears. He instructed his operatives on how best to use Churchill's own broadcast to discredit him. They were to mock him for saying that after he visited bombed areas, he came back to London not merely reassured but even refreshed. In particular, they were to seize on how Churchill had described the forces he had transferred from Egypt to Greece to confront the German invasion. Churchill had said, "It happened that the divisions available and best suited to this task were from New Zealand and Australia, and that only about half the troops who took part in this dangerous expedition came from the mother country." Goebbels leapt on this with glee. "Indeed, it so happened. It invariably so happens that the British are in the rear. It always so happens that they are in retreat. It so happened that the British had no share in the casualties. It so happened that the greatest sacrifices during the offensive in the West were made by the French, the Belgians, and the Dutch. It so happened that the Norwegians had to provide cover for the British flooding back from Norway." He ordered his propagandists to emphasize that Churchill, in choosing a public broadcast, had avoided questioning in the House of Commons. There, he might have been challenged after his speech, and awkward questions might have been asked. In his diary, Goebbels wrote, "He is frightened of Parliament." Despite the pressures of war and politics, Churchill took time to write a letter of condolence to Hubert Boileau, the exiled Prime Minister of Belgium. Even in wartime, tragedies occurred that had nothing to do with bullets and bombs, and these tended to be forgotten in the daily crush of grim events. 2 days earlier, at about 3:30 in the afternoon, the driver of an express train en route from King's Cross to Newcastle noticed a slight drag on his engine's pulling power, indicating that an emergency brake had been activated somewhere on the train. He continued on, planning to stop beside a nearby signal box in case he needed to telephone for assistance. After a second emergency cord was pulled, he brought the train to a full stop, which, given the train's speed and the fact that it was on a long downgrade, took about 3 minutes. The last three cars of the 11-car train were occupied by 100 boys returning to Ampleforth College, a Catholic boarding school situated in a lovely vale in Yorkshire. The train had been about halfway to Ampleforth, moving at over 50 miles an hour, when some of the boys, apparently bored, had begun flicking lighted matches at each other. One match fell between a seat and a wall. The seats were made of plywood, with cushions stuffed with horsehair. The coaches were timber enclosures fastened to steel chassis. A fire began to burn between the seat and the wall, and continued burning for a time without detection. The fire intensified, and soon fed by the breeze blown through open ventilation ports, began to ascend the wall. In short order, the fire engulfed the car and filled it with dense smoke. The fire killed 6 boys and injured 7. 2 of the dead were sons of the Belgian Prime Minister. "My dear Excellency," Churchill wrote on Wednesday, April 30th, "the official burdens on your shoulders are indeed heavy. I write to tell you how deeply I sympathize with you in having to bear this new burden of personal loss and sorrow." That day, at the Messerschmitt airfield outside Munich, Rudolf Hess was ready to try again. He was in his plane, engines on, waiting for permission to take off, when one of his adjutants, Pinch, came running up to the aircraft. Pinch gave him a message from Hitler, ordering Hess to stand in for him at a ceremony the next day, May 1st, Labor Day, at the Messerschmitt Works, where he was to honour several men, including Willy Messerschmitt himself, as pioneers of labour. Hess, of course, complied with Hitler's request. The Führer was everything to him. In a later letter to Hitler, Hess wrote that, "In the last 2 decades you have fulfilled my life." He saw Hitler as Germany's saviour. "After the 1918 collapse, you made it worth living again," he wrote. "For you, and also for Germany, I have been reborn and able to start once more. It has been a rare privilege for me, as well as your other subordinates, to serve such a man and to follow his ideas with such success." He climbed down from the cockpit and returned to Munich to prepare his remarks. Chapter 90. Gloom. Also that Wednesday, Lord Beaverbrook submitted yet another resignation to Churchill. "I have taken the decision to retire from the government," he wrote. "The only explanation I will offer is ill health." He tempered this with an acknowledgement of their long-standing friendship. "It is with devotion and with affection that I bring my official association to a close." He added, "Leave me still the personal relations." Churchill at last assented. As Minister of Aircraft Production, Beaverbrook had succeeded beyond all expectations, while also poisoning beyond salvation the relationship between MAP and the Air Ministry. The time had indeed come for Beaverbrook to leave the post, but Churchill was not yet willing to let his friend make a complete exit, and Beaverbrook, as so often before, was not yet willing either. On Thursday, May 1st, Churchill appointed him to the post of Minister of State, and Beaverbrook, after further protest, "You will just have to let me go," accepted the job, though he recognized that the title was as vague as its underlying mandate, which was to oversee the committees that governed all of Britain's production supply ministries. "I'm ready to be Minister of Church as well," he quipped. Though his new appointment was undoubtedly greeted with dread by many within Whitehall, it was well received among the public, according to New Yorker writer Molly Panter-Downs, who wrote that people, anxious to see the war won as quickly as possible, are hoping that the newly resurrected title of Minister of State carries with it a roving commission to kick inefficiency and departmental dawdling hard wherever it is encountered. The appointment was received with cheers. That evening, after dinner, Churchill and Clementine set off by overnight train on yet another expedition to a devastated city, this time to Plymouth, an important naval port in southwest England, which had just endured the last of a sequence of 5 intense night raids conducted over 9 days. Home intelligence put it bluntly. For the present, Plymouth, as a business and commercial centre of a prosperous countryside, has ceased to exist. The visit shook Churchill in a way that none of his tours of other bombed cities thus far had, and left him deeply affected. The sheer devastation caused by 5 nights of bombing eclipsed anything he had seen before. Whole neighbourhoods had been obliterated. In the city's Portland Square district, a direct hit on an air raid shelter had killed 76 people in an instant. Churchill visited the city's naval base, where many sailors had been wounded or killed. 40 of the injured lay on cots in a gymnasium, while across the room, behind a low curtain, men hammered the lids onto coffins containing their less lucky brethren. "The hammering must have been horrible to the injured men," wrote John Colville, who accompanied Churchill. "But such has been the damage that there was nowhere else it could be done." As Churchill's car rolled past the camera of a British Pathé newsreel crew, he stared into the lens with a look that seemed to express a mix of surprise and grief. He returned to Chequers at midnight, exhausted and saddened by what he had seen, and was met by a groundswell of fresh bad news. One of the Royal Navy's precious destroyers had been sunk at Malta, and now blocked the entrance to the Grand Harbour. Engine trouble had stalled a transport carrying tanks to the Middle East, and a British offensive in Iraq was encountering unexpectedly potent resistance from the Iraqi army. Most disheartening of all was a long, discouraging telegram from Roosevelt, in which the President seemed to dismiss the importance of defending the Middle East. "Personally, I am not downcast by more spread of Germany for additional territories," Roosevelt wrote. "There is little of raw materials in all of them put together, not enough to maintain nor compensate for huge occupation forces." Roosevelt added a callow rejoinder, "Keep up the good work." The insensitivity of Roosevelt's reply startled Churchill. The subtext seemed clear. Roosevelt was concerned only about assistance that would directly help sustain the safety of the United States from German attack, and cared little whether the Middle East fell or not. Churchill wrote to Anthony Eden, "It seems to me as if there has been a considerable recession across the Atlantic, and that quite unconsciously we are being left very much to our fate." Colville noted how the accumulation of bad news that night left Churchill in worse gloom than I have ever seen him. Churchill dictated a reply to Roosevelt, in which he sought to frame the importance of the Middle East in terms of the long-range interests of the United States itself. "We must not be too sure that the consequences of the loss of Egypt and the Middle East will not be grave," he told Roosevelt. "It would seriously increase the hazards of the Atlantic and the Pacific, and could hardly fail to prolong the war, with all the suffering and military dangers that this would entail." Churchill was growing weary of Roosevelt's reluctance to commit America to war. He had hoped that by now the United States and Britain would be fighting side by side, but always Roosevelt's actions fell short of Churchill's needs and expectations. It was true that the destroyers had been an important symbolic gift, and that the Lend-Lease program and Harriman's efficient execution of its mandate were a godsend. But it had become clear to Churchill that none of it was enough. Only America's entry into the war would guarantee victory in any reasonable period of time. One result of Churchill's long courtship of Roosevelt, however, was that now at least the Prime Minister felt able to express his concerns and wishes with more candor, directly, without fear of driving America away altogether. "Mr. President," Churchill wrote, "I am sure that you will not misunderstand me if I speak to you exactly what is in my mind. The one decisive counterweight I can see to balance the growing pessimism in Turkey, the Near East, and in Spain would be if the United States were immediately to range herself with us as a belligerent power." Before going to bed, Churchill gathered Harriman, Pug Ismay, and Colville for a late-night talk by the fire, a kind of geopolitical ghost story, in which he described, as Colville recalled, a world in which Hitler dominated all Europe, Asia, and Africa, and left the US and ourselves no option but an unwilling peace. If Suez should fall, Churchill told them, the Middle East would be lost, and Hitler's robot new order would receive the inspiration which might give it real life. The war had reached a decisive point, Churchill said, not in terms of determining ultimate victory, but rather concerning whether the war would be short or very long. If Hitler were to attain control over Iraqi oil and Ukrainian wheat, not all the staunchness of our Plymouth brethren will shorten the ordeal. Colville attributed Churchill's gloom mainly to his experience in Plymouth. At intervals throughout the night, Churchill repeated, "I have never seen the like." Chapter 91. Eric. Saturday morning brought dazzling sun, but a deep chill. That first week of May was unusually cold, marked by periods of morning frost. "The cold is incredible," Harold Nicholson wrote in his diary. "It is like February." Harriman's secretary, Micklejohn, took to filling the bathtub in his flat with hot water so that the steam would drift into his sitting room. "It has a good psychological effect," he remarked, "if nothing else." It was cold, too, in Germany. "Outside, the countryside is covered by deep snow," complained Joseph Goebbels, "and it is supposed to be almost summer." The many trees at Chequers were just beginning to show their first, almost translucent leaves, and these imparted to the landscape a pointillist effect, as if the grounds had been brushed by Paul Signac. The two nearby hills, Coombe and Beacon, were a soft green. "Everything is very late," John Colville wrote, "but the trees are at last beginning to come out." Churchill was unusually crabby. "Too little sleep made the PM irritable all morning," Colville wrote. By lunch, he was morose. The proximate cause had nothing to do with the war or Roosevelt, but rather with his discovery that Clementine had used his treasured honey, sent to him from Queensland, Australia, for the frivolous objective of sweetening rhubarb. That afternoon, Mary Churchill's suitor, Eric Duncannon, arrived, accompanied by his sister, Moira Ponsonby, the young woman with whom Colville had examined the downed German bomber at Stansted Park. Duncannon's arrival was a surprise to all, Mary included, and was not wholly welcome. He had been invited only for lunch the following day, Sunday, but was now pretending that he had been asked to stay for the whole weekend. His presence added new tension to the day. Eric clearly was courting Mary, and seemed likely that weekend to ask her to marry him. Mary was willing, but unhappy with the lack of enthusiasm expressed by members of her family. Her mother objected. Her sister Sarah openly ridiculed the idea. Mary was just too young. In the afternoon, Churchill settled in the garden and worked on various notes and minutes. The destruction of Plymouth remained vivid in his mind. It galled him that the Germans had managed to attack the city on 5 nights out of 9, with minimal interference by the RAF. He still placed great faith in the prof's aerial minds, though everyone else seemed to view them with derision. Clearly frustrated, Churchill dictated a note to Air Chief Marshal Charles Portal and to John Moore Brabazon, the new Minister of Aircraft Production, asking why the RAF squadron charged with deploying aerial mines did not yet have its full complement of 18 aircraft. "How is it that only 7 are available for supply, in view of the fact that they are hardly ever allowed to go up into the air? Why is a town like Plymouth left to be subjected to 5 raids on successive nights, or almost successive, without this device being used? And why," he asked, "were aerial mines not being launched across the German radio beams that guided bombers to their targets? I do not feel this device is yet free from the many years of obstruction which have hampered its perfection," he wrote. "Recent action by the Royal Air Force against the night raider has flagged sadly, and you cannot afford to neglect a method which, for the number of times it has been used, has produced an extraordinarily high percentage of results." Exactly what he was referring to here is unclear. The mines had yet to be deployed in routine service. Air Ministry researchers were focusing their attentions more on improving air-to-air radar to help fighters locate targets at night and, led by Dr. R. V. Jones, on perfecting technologies for finding and manipulating German navigational beams. In this, they were making advances, to the point where, according to interrogation reports, German pilots were growing increasingly distrustful of the beams. The RAF was becoming adept at diverting beams and using starfish decoy fires to then convince German pilots that they had reached the right targets. Luck still played an inordinately large role in determining whether these measures could be deployed with enough precision to disrupt attacks, like those levelled at Plymouth, but clear progress was being made. Aerial mines, however, had proven to be nothing but problematic, and no one other than Churchill and the Prof seemed to think them worthwhile. Only Churchill's enthusiasm, his power relay, drove their continued development. Churchill's mood improved that evening. A fierce battle was taking place at Tobruk, and nothing thrilled him more than spirited warfare and the prospect of military glory. He stayed up until 3:30 in high spirits, laughing, chaffing, and alternating business with conversation, wrote Colville. One by one, his official guests, including Anthony Eden, gave up and went to bed. Churchill, however, continued to hold forth, his audience reduced to only Colville and Mary's potential suitor, Eric Duncannon. Mary, by this point, had retired to the prison room, aware that the next day held the potential to change her life forever. In Berlin, meanwhile, Hitler and propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels joked about a newly published English biography of Churchill that revealed many of his idiosyncrasies, including his penchant for wearing pink silk underwear, working in the bathtub, and drinking throughout the day. "He dictates messages in the bath or in his underpants, a startling image which the Führer finds hugely amusing," Goebbels wrote in his diary on Saturday, he sees the English Empire as slowly disintegrating. Not much will be salvageable. On Sunday morning, a low-grade anxiety coloured the Cromwellian reaches of Chequers. Today, it seemed, would be the day Eric Duncannon proposed to Mary, and no one other than Mary was happy about it. Even she, however, was not wholly at ease with the idea. She was 18 years old, and had never had a romantic relationship, let alone been seriously courted. The prospect of betrothal left her feeling emotionally roiled, though it did add a certain piquancy to the day. New guests arrived. Sarah Churchill, the prof, and Churchill's 20-year-old niece, Clarissa Spencer Churchill, looking quite beautiful, Colville noted. She was accompanied by Captain Alan Hilgarth, a raffishly handsome novelist and self-styled adventurer, now serving as naval attaché in Madrid, where he ran intelligence operations. Some of these were engineered with the help of a lieutenant on his staff, Ian Fleming, who later credited Captain Hilgarth as being one of the inspirations for James Bond. It was obvious, Colville wrote, that Eric was expected to make advances to Mary, and that the prospect was viewed with nervous pleasure by Mary, with approbation by Moira, with dislike by Mrs. C., and with amusement by Clarissa. Churchill expressed little interest. After lunch, Mary and the others walked into the Rose Garden, while Colville showed Churchill telegrams about the situation in Iraq. The day was sunny and warm, a nice change from the recent stretch of cold. Soon, to Colville's mystification, Eric and Clarissa set off on a long walk over the grounds by themselves, leaving Mary behind. His motives, Colville wrote, were either Clarissa's attraction, which she did not attempt to keep in the background, or else the belief that it was good policy to arouse Mary's jealousy. After the walk, and after Clarissa and Captain Hilgarth had left, Eric took a nap, with the apparent intention, as Colville saw it, of later making a dramatic entry in the long gallery where the family and guests, including Eden and Harriman, were to gather for afternoon tea. Colville wrote, I think all this is a flutter, which pleases Eric's theatrical feelings and stirs Mary's youthful emotions, but will have no serious consequence. Churchill settled himself in the garden for an afternoon's work, to take advantage of the warmth of the day as he went through the top-secret papers in his yellow box. Colville sat nearby. Now and then Churchill glanced at him with a look of suspicion, in the belief that I was trying to read the contents of his special buff boxes. Eric took Mary aside in the white parlour. This evening, Eric proposed to me, Mary wrote in her diary. I'm in a daze. I think I've said yes, but oh dear God, I'm in a muddle. Churchill worked late into the night. Colville and the prof, pale, quiet, looming, joined him in his room, where Churchill climbed into bed and began making his way through the day's accumulation of reports and minutes. The prof sat nearby while Colville stood at the foot of the bed to collect materials as Churchill went through them. This continued until after 2 in the morning. Colville returned to London the next day, Monday, May 5th, in a state of exhaustion. Chapter 92. Le Cœur dit. Mary, Monday, May 5th. I've struggled all day within myself. Mummy came back again. Nana came. I must keep calm. Long walks in the garden. Finally succumbed to tears. But happy. Chapter 93. Of Panzers and Pansies. The great parliamentary debate on Churchill's handling of the war opened on Tuesday, May 6th. With a lacklustre speech by Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden, who began by saying, There is much that I would like to tell which, perforce, I am unable to tell at the present time. He then proceeded to say little, and to say it badly. He sat down amidst complete silence, wrote Chips Channon, Eden's parliamentary private secretary. I have never heard an important speech so badly delivered. A succession of short speeches followed, delivered by members from throughout the realm. One persistent theme was dismay at the fact that Churchill had made this a vote of confidence when all the House had asked for was a debate on the war. Why should my right honourable friend, the Prime Minister, challenge us with this motion? said one member. Does he regard criticism as unseemly? A socialist member from Glasgow, John McGovern, delivered the most pointed attack of the day, going so far as to criticise Churchill's practice of visiting bombed cities. He said, "When we have got to the stage when the Prime Minister has to parade himself through every bombed area in the country, and has to sit on the back of a wagonette waving his hat on a stick like a doodles at the circus, well, it has come to a very sad state of affairs when representatives of the government are not so sure of the opinions of the people of the country." McGovern professed to have no confidence in the war or the government, adding, "And while I have a tremendous admiration for the oratorical powers of the Prime Minister, who can almost make you believe that black is white, I have no faith in his achieving anything of lasting benefit to humanity." Most speakers, however, were careful to leaven their criticism with praise for the Prime Minister, which at times veered toward the mawkish. "In my lifetime," said one, "I cannot remember any minister who has inspired such confidence and enthusiasm as our present Prime Minister." Another member, Major Maurice Petherick, avowing that all he wanted was for the government to be a bit stronger and more powerful, offered one of the more memorable statements of the debate. "We want a panzer and not a pansy government." The main criticism throughout the two-day debate was the government's apparent failure to wage war effectively. "It is of but momentary utility to have striking power if you cannot hold what you conquer," said Leslie Hoare Belisha, who had headed Chamberlain's War Office. He also criticised Churchill's growing dependence on America. "Are we relying on winning this war by our own efforts?" he asked. "Or are we putting off anything that can be done in the belief that the United States will supply the defects? If so, we are misguided. We ought to thank God for President Roosevelt every day, but it is unfair to him and to his country to overstate what is possible." Though Churchill had asked for the vote of confidence, it galled him to have to listen to speech after speech, carping on the alleged failings of his government. He was thick-skinned, but only to a point. Even Averil Harriman's daughter Cathy recognised this after spending a later weekend at Chequers. "He hates criticism," she wrote. "It hurts him as it would a child being unjustly spanked by a mother." On one occasion, he told his great friend Violet Bonham Carter, "I feel very biteful and spiteful when people attack me." The most wounding speech, however, did not come until later. Mary, Tuesday, May 6th. "Feel calmer today? I really can't write all I think and feel. I only know I am most seriously and deeply looking at every aspect of it. The trouble is I have so little to judge by. And yet I do love Eric. I know I do. The family have been quite wonderful. So helpful and understanding. I wish I could write about all that has happened in detail, but somehow it all seems too unreal and strange, and too important and pent up to write down calmly." The attack came on the second day of debate, Wednesday, May 7th, and it came from David Lloyd George, of all people. 1 year earlier, he had been instrumental in helping Churchill become Prime Minister. The war, he said now, had entered one of its most difficult and discouraging phases. This in itself was not a surprise, he noted. Setbacks were to be expected. "But we have had our third, our fourth great defeat and retreat. We have trouble now in Iraq and Libya. We have the Germans' seizure of the islands, the Channel Islands, of which Guernsey and Jersey were the largest. We have tremendous havoc among our shipping, not merely in losses, but in what has not been taken enough into account in damage." He called for an end of the kind of blunders which have discredited and weakened us. He singled out what he saw as the government's failure to provide adequate information about events. "We are not an infantile nation," he said, "and it is not necessary to withhold unpleasant facts from us so as not to frighten us." And he accused Churchill of failing to install an effective war cabinet. "There is no doubt about his brilliant qualities," Lloyd George said. "But for that very reason, if he will allow me to say so, he wants a few more ordinary persons." Lloyd George spoke for an hour. "Weak, at times," wrote Chips Channon, "at others sly and shrewd, and often vindictive as he attacked the government." Churchill, Channon wrote, was obviously shaken, for he shook, twitched, and his hands were never still. But now, at just after 4 o'clock, it was his turn to speak. He exuded energy and confidence as well as pugnacious good cheer. He held the house from the very first moment, wrote Harold Nicholson in his diary, very amusing, very frank. He was also merciless. He directed his opening salvo at Lloyd George. If there were any speech which I felt was not particularly exhilarating, he said, it was the speech of my right honourable friend, the member for Carnarvon Boroughs. Churchill condemned it as being unhelpful during a time that Lloyd George himself had described as discouraging and disheartening. It was not the sort of speech which one would have expected from the great war leader of former days, who was accustomed to brush aside despondency and alarm and push on irresistibly towards the final goal, Churchill said. It was the sort of speech with which, I imagine, the illustrious and venerable Marshal Pétain might well have enlivened the closing days of Monsieur Renault's cabinet. He defended his decision to ask for a vote of confidence, because after our reverses and disappointments in the field, His Majesty's government have a right to know where they stand with the House of Commons and where the House of Commons stands with the country. In a clear allusion to the United States, he said, Still more is this knowledge important for the sake of foreign nations, especially nations which are balancing their policy at the present time and who ought to be left in no doubt about the stability or otherwise of this resolved and obstinate war government. As he neared his close, he reprised the speech he had made 1 year earlier in his first address to the House as Prime Minister. I ask you to witness, Mr. Speaker, that I have never promised anything or offered anything but blood, tears, toil, and sweat, to which I will now add our fair share of mistakes, shortcomings, and disappointments, and also that this may go on for a very long time, at the end of which I firmly believe, though it is not a promise or a guarantee, only a profession of faith, that there will be complete, absolute, and final victory. Acknowledging that 1 year, almost to a day, had passed since his appointment as Prime Minister, he invited his audience to consider all that had occurred during that time. When I look back on the perils which have been overcome, upon the great mountain waves in which the gallant ship has driven, when I remember all that has gone wrong, and remember also all that has gone right, I feel sure we have no need to fear the tempest. Let it roar, and let it rage. We shall come through. As Churchill made his exit, the House erupted in cheers, which continued outside the chamber in the members' lobby. And then came the vote. That day, Harriman composed a letter to Roosevelt to convey some of his impressions about Churchill and Britain's ability to endure the war. Harriman had no illusions as to why Churchill held him so close and took him along on so many inspections of bombed cities. He thinks it of value to have an American around for the morale of the people, Harriman told Roosevelt. But Harriman understood that this was only a secondary consideration. He also wants me to report to you from time to time. By now, what had long been clear to Churchill was also clear to Harriman, that Britain had no hope of winning the war without the direct intervention of the United States. Harriman understood that it was his own role to serve as a lens through which Roosevelt could see beyond censorship and propaganda into the heart of Britain's war-making architecture. He knew aircraft totals, production rates, food reserves, and the disposition of warships, and thanks to the many visits to bombed cities, he knew the scent of cordite and decomposing bodies. Just as important, he understood the interplay of personalities around Churchill. He knew, for example, that Max Beaverbrook, Churchill's newly designated Minister of State, was now charged with doing for tanks what he had done for fighters when he was Minister of Aircraft Production. Britain had neglected the matter of tanks and was paying the price in the Middle East. The Libyan campaign in both directions was a rude shock to many, and there would be great pressure for increased production both in England and America, Harriman wrote. More and better tanks were also needed for England's defence against invasion, if its home forces were to be able to resist incursions by Hitler's armoured units. Those in charge of tanks tell me it is rather ironic that Beaverbrook is now to help them, as he has been the worst offender in stealing things they have needed, meaning materials and tools. Beaverbrook is not personally liked, but people know he is the only man who can really cut the red tape, and he is welcomed as an ally. Now, however, Beaverbrook's health was becoming a factor. He is none too well, suffering from asthma and an eye affliction, Harriman told Roosevelt. Nevertheless, Harriman expected that Beaverbrook would stay on and would succeed. I gather from conversations with both the Prime Minister and Beaverbrook that he will end by being the number one troubleshooter. It was obvious to Harriman that Churchill dearly hoped America would intervene in the war, but that he and others in the government were being careful not to push too hard. It is natural that they hope for a belligerent status, he told Roosevelt, but I am surprised how understanding all are of the psychology of the situation at home. Mary, Wednesday, May 7th. Had made up my mind. Eric rang up in PM. Still determined to escape 10 Downing, John Colville sought to further improve his odds by again asking Churchill's fixer, Brendan Bracken, to intercede on his behalf. But again, Bracken failed. Churchill simply would not let him go. No one seemed willing to support him. Opposition by the Foreign Office grew more stern now that Eric Seal, Churchill's lead private secretary, was being dispatched to America on a special mission, leaving an absence in the secretariat that had to be filled. Even Colville's two older brothers, David and Philip, both with military commissions, gave him no encouragement. David, a Navy man, seemed especially hostile to the idea. He is violently opposed to my joining the RAF, Colville wrote in his diary. His reasons were many of them offensive, such as my practical incapacity in which he and Philip firmly but wrongly believe, but I did not mind as I knew they were in reality based on nothing but affection and the fear that I should be killed. Colville's resolve only grew. His goal now was to become a fighter pilot, if humanly possible. The first step was to begin the process of getting fitted for contact lenses, an arduous venture. The lenses were made of plastic, but were still scleral lenses that covered most of the eye, and were notoriously uncomfortable. The whole affair, the fitting, the endless shaping and reshaping of the lenses, and the slow process of growing acclimated to discomfort and irritation, required stamina. Colville deemed it worthwhile. And now that he was actually taking concrete steps toward entering the RAF, he found himself getting caught up in the romance of it all, as if his commission were already a certainty. He told his diary, "My head is full of plans for a new life in the RAF, and, of course, of improbable daydreams on the subject." From the time of his first fitting to when he could at last wear his completed lenses would take 2 months. In the House of Commons, the members lined up in the lobby. The tellers took their positions. Only 3 members voted no. Even Lloyd George supported Churchill's proposed resolution. The tally in the end was 447-3. "Pretty good," Harold Nicholson quipped. That night, according to Colville, Churchill went to bed elated. Chapter 94. Le Coeur Encore. Thursday, May 8th. Rushed up to London. Eric to dinner. Felt very happy. Mummy anxious for wedding to be put off for 6 months. Clearly she's not very taken with Eric. Went to bed feeling perplexed, doubtful, sleepy. Friday, May 9th. Felt miserable, uncertain. Had hair done. Eric came and we walked round St. James Park. Lovely day. Sweet lovers love the spring. Once with him, somehow all fears and doubts seemed to go. Returned to lunch happy, confident. Decided. Lord and Lady Bessborough to lunch. Families confer. Engagement is to be announced following Wednesday. Joy. Chapter 95. Moonrise. In Berlin, Joseph Goebbels dismissed Churchill's speech in the House of Commons as being full of excuses and devoid of information. But no sign of weakness, he acknowledged in his diary on Friday, May 9th, adding, "England's will to resist is still intact. We shall therefore have to continue attacking and chipping away at her power position." Goebbels confessed in his diary to feeling a new respect for Churchill. "This man is a strange mixture of heroism and cunning," he wrote. "If he had come to power in 1933, we would not be where we are today, and I believe that he will give us a few more problems yet. But we can and will solve them. Nevertheless, he is not to be taken as lightly as we usually take him." For Goebbels, it had been a long and trying week, and he settled in with his diary to take stock. There had been personnel issues to deal with. One of his key men wanted to quit and join the army. "Everyone wants to go to the front," Goebbels wrote, "but who is going to do the work here?" The war against British shipping was going well, as was Rommel's campaign in North Africa, and the Soviet Union appeared unaware that the German invasion was imminent. But two nights earlier, the RAF had launched a series of heavy raids against Hamburg, Bremen, and other cities, killing 100 in Hamburg alone. "We shall have our hands full dealing with it," he wrote. He expected the Luftwaffe to launch a punishing reprisal. He noted also that British newspapers were publishing strong criticism of Churchill, but he doubted this had any real significance. As best he could tell, Churchill remained firmly in power. "How good that a difficult week ends today," Goebbels wrote. "I am tired and battle-weary. One can never escape from the din of it all. Meanwhile, the weather has turned gloriously fine. Full moon. Ideal for rare raids." In London on Friday, May 9th, John Colville wrote in his diary that Eric Duncannon and his parents, the Bessborers, had come to the annex for lunch with Mary and the Churchills. Afterward, Mary announced to Colville that she was engaged. "I was relieved to be able simply to wish her happiness," he wrote. "I had feared she might be going to ask my opinion of him." That evening, Mary and Eric took a train to the village of Leatherhead, about 20 miles southwest of London, to visit the headquarters of General A.G.L. Macnaghten, commander of Canadian forces in Britain. Eric was one of Macnaghten's staff officers. Mary's friend Moira, Eric's sister, was there as well, and Mary was happy to report in her diary that Moira seemed pleased about the engagement. Mary's confidence surged. With a full moon pending, Churchill set off for Ditchley, and a weekend that would bring that first full year of his premiership to a blazing, fantastical end. Part 7. 1 year to the day. May 10th, 1941. Chapter 96. A Beam Named Anton. Late on Friday night, May 9th, a group of senior Nazi officials and the lesser lights with whom Hitler filled his innermost circle gathered at the Berghof in the Bavarian Alps. Hitler could not sleep. He was, by this point, plagued by insomnia. And if he could not sleep, then no one would sleep. Hitler's waiters, members of the SS or Schutzstaffel, Hitler's elite guard, served tea and coffee. Tobacco and alcohol were forbidden. A fire roared in the hearth. Hitler's dog, Blondie, an Alsatian, later known as a German shepherd, basked in the warmth and in Hitler's attention. As always, Hitler spoke in monologues, on topics that ranged from vegetarianism to the best way to train a dog. Time advanced slowly. His guests, including Eva Braun, listened with accustomed obedience, barely censored in the warmth and flickering light, as a freshet of words flowed past them in which they were obliged to wade. Hitler's most senior men were absent, notably Rudolf Hess, Heinrich Himmler, Göring, and Goebbels. But Martin Bormann, his ambitious private secretary, was present, savoring the growing trust showed him by his Führer, and aware that the night could produce a further opportunity to advance his campaign to supplant Hess as Hitler's deputy. In the course of the coming day, Bormann was to get some very good news on this score, though for Hitler and everyone else in his hierarchy, it would appear to be the worst news possible. At about 2 a.m., Bormann reminded the group of the recent RAF raids on Germany, taking pains to point out that Göring's precious Luftwaffe had done little to oppose the onslaught and that the raids had gone unanswered. Germany had to respond in force, he said. Another guest, Hans Bauer, Hitler's personal pilot, seconded the idea. Hitler was resistant. He wanted all resources focused on the coming invasion of Russia. But Bormann and Bauer knew their chief and argued that a massive raid against London was a necessity to save face. A raid, moreover, would help camouflage the Russian invasion by demonstrating Germany's continued commitment to conquering England. By dawn, Hitler was in a rage. At 8 o'clock Saturday morning, he called the Luftwaffe's chief of staff, Hans Jeschonek, and ordered a reprisal raid on London, using every available aircraft. Clementine was indeed unhappy about Mary's engagement to Eric Duncannon. On Saturday, from Ditchley, she wrote a letter to Max Beaverbrook in which she confessed her doubts. That she would write to him at all, let alone about such a personal matter, was an index of the depth of her anxiety, given how much she disliked and distrusted him. "It has all happened with stunning rapidity," Clementine wrote. "The engagement is to be made public next Wednesday, but I want you to know beforehand, because you are fond of Mary. I have persuaded Winston to be firm and to say they must wait 6 months. She is only 18, is young for her age, has not seen many people, and I think she was simply swept off her feet with excitement. They do not know each other at all." She closed, "Please keep my doubts and fears to yourself." That day, by chance, Mary ran into Beaverbrook as he rode horseback along a country lane. His own estate, Chalkley, was a mile and a half from the headquarters of General McNaughton's Canadian forces. "He did not seem very pleased," Mary wrote in her diary. "He telephoned her later, however, and was very sweet," a term that few people ever applied to Beaverbrook. Then Pamela, who was spending the weekend at Chalkley with her young son, stopped by, bringing a gift of 2 brooches and some advice. "She looked grave," Mary noted. Mary did not particularly want any advice, but Pamela delivered it anyway. "Don't marry someone because they want to marry you, but because you want to marry them." Mary dismissed it. "I didn't pay much attention at the time," she wrote in her diary, "and yet it stuck, and I kept on thinking of it." General McNaughton and his wife threw a small afternoon party for Mary and Eric, where the guests offered toasts to their good health. The timing of the engagement, of the party and the toasts, struck Mary as being freighted with broader meaning, for the guests, acknowledging the first-year anniversary of her father's appointment, also drank to his continued good health. "Today, a year ago, he became Prime Minister. What a year! It seems so long," she wrote in her diary, "and standing there with everybody around, I remembered how last year I had been at Chartwell and heard Chamberlain's voice telling the world that Papa was Prime Minister. And I remembered the orchard at Chartwell and the blossoms and daffodils shimmering through the quiet twilight, and how I cried and prayed in the stillness." She had a long talk with Eric alone, and by day's end felt her confidence begin to falter. That afternoon, the RAF's No. 80 wing, established to track Germany's use of navigational beams and to devise countermeasures, discovered that Germany had activated its beam transmitters, indicating that a raid was likely to occur that night. Operators plotted the vectors, then notified the RAF's local filter room, which analysed and prioritised reports of incoming aircraft and passed them along to fighter command and whatever other units might find the information important. The RAF declared this a fighter night, meaning it would assign single-engine fighters to patrol the skies over London, while restricting the firing of anti-aircraft guns to avoid bringing down friendly aircraft. The designation required a bright moon and clear skies. In a seeming paradox, on such nights the RAF ordered its twin-engine night fighters to stay at least 10 miles from the designated patrol zone, owing to their resemblance to German bombers. At 5:15 p.m., an officer in the filter room placed a call to the headquarters of the London Fire Service. "Good afternoon, sir," the officer told the fire service's deputy chief. "The beam is on London." The transmitting station for this beam was located in Cherbourg, on the French coast, and had the code name Anton. 2 minutes later, the deputy chief asked the Home Office to authorise the massing in London of 1,000 fire trucks. Chapter 97. Interloper. The weather on Saturday, May 10th, seemed ideal. There were clouds over the North Sea at 1,600 feet, but the skies over Glasgow were clear. The moon that night would be just shy of full, with moonrise at 8:45 p.m. and sunset at 10 o'clock. Moonlight would give him a clear view of the landmarks he had memorised from his map of Scotland. But it was not just the weather that made the timing seem favourable. In January, a member of Hess's staff, who often produced horoscopes for him, had forecast that a major conjunction of the planets would occur on May 10th, as would a full moon. He also delivered a horoscope that revealed early May to be an ideal time for whatever personal endeavours Hess wished to pursue. The idea for the flight had come to Hess in a dream. He was now, he believed, in the hands of supernatural forces, a notion further affirmed when his mentor, Karl Haushofer, told him about a dream of his own, in which Hess appeared to be strolling in an untroubled manner through the halls of an English palace. Hess packed for his trip. Known to be a hypochondriac of the first order, inclined to indulge in all manner of homeopathic cures and to hang magnets above his bed, he gathered together a collection of his favourite remedies, what he called his medicinal comforts. These included a tin case containing 8 ampules of drugs for relieving intestinal spasms and to ease anxiety, with such names as Spasmalgin and Pantopon, a metal box with a hypodermic syringe and 4 needles, 12 square tablets of dextrose with the product name Dextroenergen, 2 tin boxes containing 35 tablets of various sizes and colours, ranging from white to speckled brown, containing caffeine, magnesia, aspirin, and other ingredients. A glass bottle marked Bayer, containing a white powder made of sodium bicarbonate, sodium phosphate, sodium sulfate, and citric acid, for use as a laxative. A tube containing 10 tablets of a mild concentration of atropine, useful for colic and to ease motion sickness. 7 bottles of aromatic brown liquid to be administered by droplet. A small flask containing a solution of sodium chloride and alcohol. 28 tablets of pervitin, an amphetamine, for maintaining wakefulness and standard issued to German soldiers. 2 bottles of antiseptic solutions. 1 bottle containing 60 tiny white pellets containing various homeopathic substances. 4 small boxes with 20 tablets each, labelled variously as Digitalis, Colocynthis, and Antimon Crud. 10 tablets of homeopathic ingredients, 7 white, 3 brown. A box marked aspirin but containing opiates, motion sickness drugs, and soporifics, and a packet marked sweets. He also brought along a small flashlight, a safety razor blade, and material for making earplugs. He said goodbye to his wife and son and drove to the airfield at Augsburg, accompanied by Pinch, his adjutant. In the cockpit, he stowed a satchel containing his medicines and elixirs and a Leica camera. He told airport officials that he was flying to Norway. His true destination was Scotland, specifically a landing strip 18 air miles south of Glasgow, 825 miles from Augsburg. Once again, he gave Adjutant Pinch a sealed envelope, again forbidding him to open it until 4 hours had passed. This time, as Pinch found later, the envelope contained 4 letters, one each to be delivered to Hess's wife, Ilse, to a fellow pilot whose flight kit he had borrowed, to Willy Messerschmitt, and to Adolf Hitler himself. At about 6 p.m. German time, Hess took off from the Messerschmitt Works airfield at Augsburg and made a wide sweeping turn to ensure that the aircraft was working properly. Then he headed northwest, toward the city of Bonn. Next, he found a key railroad junction, which told him he was on course. He then sought Darmstadt, off to his right, and soon a point near Wiesbaden, where the Rhine and the Main rivers meet. He made a minor correction in his course. The Siebengebirge, or 7 Peaks, came into view just south of Bonn. Across the Rhine from this was Bad Godesberg, which conjured for Hess pleasant memories of both his childhood and periods he had spent there with Hitler, the last time when the fall of France was imminent. Somehow Hermann Göring learned of Hess's departure and feared the worst. He may have been alerted when, just after 9 o'clock that night, Hess's adjutant, Pinch, called Luftwaffe headquarters in Berlin and asked for a navigational beam to be transmitted along a line from Augsburg to Dungavel House, south of Glasgow. Pinch was told he could have his beam, but only until 10 p.m., because all beams would be required that night for a massive raid against London. That evening, fighter ace Adolf Galland, now in charge of his entire fighter wing, received a telephone call from Göring himself. The Reichsmarschall was clearly distressed. He ordered Galland to immediately get his entire fighter wing, his Geschwader, into the air. "With your whole Geschwader, understand," Göring repeated. Galland was perplexed. To begin with, it was already getting dark, he wrote later, and furthermore, there were no reports of any enemy aircraft flying in. He told Göring as much. "Flying in," Göring said. "What do you mean by flying in? You are supposed to stop an aircraft flying out The Deputy Führer has gone mad and is flying to England in an ME-110. He must be brought down. And Gallant, call me personally when you get back. Gallant asked for details. When had Hess taken off? What course was he likely to be flying? Gallant faced a quandary. The sky would be dark in about 10 minutes, making it next to impossible to find another aircraft with such a head start. What's more, many ME-110s were likely to be airborne at that moment. How should we know which was the one Rudolf Hess was flying? Gallant recalled asking himself. He decided to comply with Göring's orders, but only in part. Just as a token, I ordered a takeoff. Each squadron leader was to send up one or two planes. I did not tell them why. They must have thought I had gone mad. Gallant consulted a map. The distance to Britain from Augsburg was extreme. Even with additional fuel, Hess was unlikely to reach his goal. What's more, for a good part of the flight he would be within reach of England's fighter force. Should Hess really succeed in getting from Augsburg as far as the British Isles, Gallant told himself, the Spitfires would get him sooner or later. After a suitable interval, Gallant called Göring and told him his fighters had failed to find Hess. He assured Göring that it was unlikely the Deputy Führer would survive the flight. As Rudolf Hess neared the northeast coast of England, he dropped his extra fuel tanks, now empty and causing needless aerodynamic drag. These fell into the sea off Lindisfarne. At 10:10 p.m. that Saturday, Britain's Chain Home Radar Defence Network detected a solo aircraft over the North Sea, flying toward England's Northumberland coast at about 12,000 feet at high speed. The aircraft was assigned an identifier, Raid 42. Soon after this, a member of the Royal Observer Corps, Durham, heard the aircraft and plotted the sound as being about 7 miles northeast of the coastal town of Alnwick, England, near the Scottish border. The plane began a rapid descent. Moments later, an observer in the village of Chatton, a dozen miles north, got a glimpse of the aircraft as it roared past, at a mere 50 feet above the ground. The observer saw it clearly silhouetted by moonlight, identified it as an ME-110, and reported it as such. The controller on duty at Durham dismissed this as highly improbable. That kind of aircraft was never seen this far north, and would never have enough fuel to be able to make it back to Germany. The observer, however, insisted his identification was correct. The plane was next spotted by observers at two more outposts, Jedburgh and Ashkirk, who reported it to be flying at about 5,000 feet. They, too, identified it as an ME-110 and notified their superiors. Their reports were forwarded to Fighter Command's No. 13 group, which dismissed them as ludicrous. The observers had to be mistaken, the group officials assumed. Probably they had spotted a Dornier bomber, which also had two engines and two tail fins, and was capable of making a flight of such a great distance. But now observers in Glasgow plotted the speed of the aircraft and found it was travelling at over 300 miles an hour, far beyond the maximum of a Dornier bomber. What's more, an RAF night fighter, a two-man Defiant, dispatched to intercept the intruder, was falling behind. An assistant group officer with the Observer Corps, Major Graham Donald, ordered a message sent to Fighter Command to the effect that the aircraft could not possibly be a Dornier. It had to be an ME-110. RAF officials received this message with hoots of derision. The aircraft, meanwhile, had flown over Scotland and exited the country's west coast over the Firth of Clyde. It then turned around and flew back over the mainland, where an observer in the coastal village of West Kilbride got a clear look at the plane as it rocketed past at a tree-pruning altitude of 25 feet. The RAF still rejected the identification. Two Spitfires joined the Defiant in hunting for the intruder. Meanwhile, operators at radar stations farther to the south began watching something far more ominous. From the look of it, hundreds of aircraft were massing over the coast of France. Chapter 98. The Cruelest Raid. The first bombers crossed into English skies shortly before 11 p.m. The initial sortie consisted of 20 bombers attached to the elite KGR-100 Firestarter group, although that night the marker fires were pretty much a needless accessory given the brilliant moon and clear skies. Hundreds of bombers followed. Officially, as in past raids, the targets were to be those of military significance, including in this raid the Victoria and West India docks and the big Battersea power station, but as every pilot understood, these targets ensured that bombs would fall upon all quarters of civilian London. Whether planned or not, during this raid, as indicated by the pattern of damage, the Luftwaffe seemed intent on destroying London's most historic treasures and killing Churchill and his government. Over the next 6 hours, 505 bombers, carrying 7,000 incendiaries and 718 tons of high-explosive bombs of all sizes, swarmed the sky over London. Thousands of bombs fell and ripped into all corners of the city, but they did especially grave damage in Whitehall and Westminster. Bombs hit Westminster Abbey, the Tower of London, the Law Courts. One bomb sliced through the tower that housed Big Ben. To everyone's relief, the clock's immense bell boomed just minutes afterward at 2 a.m. Fire consumed a large portion of the famous roof of Westminster Hall, built in the 11th century by King William Rufus, William II. In Bloomsbury, flames raced through the British Museum, destroying an estimated 250,000 books and devouring the Roman Britain Room, the Greek Bronze Room, and the Prehistoric Room. Happily, as a precaution, the exhibits in these rooms had been removed for safekeeping. A bomb struck the Peak Freen cookie factory, which now also made tank parts. Two parachute mines blew up a cemetery, scattering old bones and fragments of monuments over the landscape and launching a coffin lid into the bedroom of a nearby house. The irate homeowner, in bed with his wife at the time, carried the lid out of the house and brought it to a group of rescue workers. "I was in bed with my missus when this bloody thing came through the window," he said. "What do I do with it?" In Regent's Park, at number 43 York Terrace, 99 members of the Group for Sacrifice and Service, the English affiliate of a California cult, gathered in an apparently abandoned house for a service held to worship the full moon. The roof was made of glass. A full dinner buffet had been laid out in the central hall of the house. At 1:45 a.m., a bomb struck, killing many of the worshippers. Rescue workers found victims dressed in white robes that appeared to be the vestments of priests. Against the white cloth, blood appeared black. The group's archbishop, Bertha Orton, a devotee of the occult, was killed. A gold cross encrusted with diamonds still hung around her neck. It was nearly 11 p.m. The ME-110, flown by Rudolf Hess, was almost out of fuel. He had only a vague idea as to where he was. After flying past the west coast of Scotland and then turning around, he again descended to a hair's breadth altitude to get a better look at the landscape. Pilots called this contour flying. He flew in a zigzag pattern, clearly hunting for a recognizable landmark as his fuel dwindled. It was now dark, though the landscape below was bathed in moonlight. Hess, realizing that he would never find the landing strip at Dungavel House, decided to bail out. He increased his altitude. After flying high enough to allow for a safe jump, he shut off his engines and opened his cockpit. The force of the onrushing wind held him pinned to his seat. Hess remembered the advice of a German fighter commander that in order to escape an aircraft quickly, a pilot should roll his plane over and let gravity help. Whether Hess did so or not is unclear. The plane entered a steep upward climb, at which point Hess lost consciousness. He awoke and fell from the cockpit, striking a foot on one of the plane's twin tail fins as he fell through the moonlit night. Harriman's secretary, Robert Micklejohn, spent that Saturday at work. Harriman left at 1:30 in the afternoon to return to the Dorchester, the only place where we can really get anything done, Micklejohn wrote in his diary. Micklejohn wound up having lunch at his desk and working until 5 p.m., much to his disgust. Afterward, he went to a girl show at the Prince of Wales Theatre called 1901. He had hoped for something bawdy and risque, but instead got a tame vaudeville show that lasted from 6:30 until 9 o'clock, after which he returned to the office to see if a reply had come to a cable Harriman had sent to the United States that morning. Micklejohn was on his way home at about 11 o'clock when the air raid siren sounded. He heard gunfire, but otherwise the night was quiet, the city bright under the full moon. He reached his apartment safely. All of a sudden, about midnight, I heard a rain of objects on the roof and against the building and saw bright flashing blue lights through the drawn curtains, he wrote in his diary. took a look out and saw dozens of incendiaries sputtering around in the street and small park below, making a bluish light like electric sparks, my first close contact with incendiaries. As he watched, he heard noises in the hall and found that his neighbours were heading down to the shelter in the building's basement. A visiting airman had advised them that incendiaries were invariably followed by bombs. "I took the hint," Micklejohn wrote. He put on his treasured fur coat, I didn't want it to get blitzed, and headed downstairs to begin his first ever night in a shelter. Soon, high-explosive bombs began to fall. At 1 a.m, a bomb landed just beyond a corner of the building, igniting a gas main that lit the night so brightly Micklejohn believed he could have read a newspaper by its light. This caused considerable stir among those who knew what it was all about, he wrote, because it was almost a sure thing that the bombers would concentrate on us with the fires as a target. More incendiaries fell. Then the bombs started coming down fast for a while, in sticks of 3 and 6 that sounded like gun salvos. The upper floors of neighboring buildings caught fire. Detonations shook the building. Several times during lulls in the bombing, Micklejohn and a trio of U.S. Army officers left the building to examine the accumulating damage, careful not to venture more than a block away. Just after 11 p.m., an observer in Eaglesham, Scotland, about 25 miles inland from the west coast, reported that an aircraft had crashed and burst into flames. He reported, too, that the pilot had bailed out and appeared to have landed safely. The time was now 9 minutes after 11. To the south, hundreds of German bombers were crossing the English coastline. The mystery pilot drifted to earth near Flaw's Farm on Bonnerton Moor, where a farmer found him and took him to his cottage. The farmer offered him tea. The pilot declined. It was too late in the day for tea. He asked for water instead. Police arrived and took the man to their station in Giffnock, about 5 air miles from central Glasgow. They locked him in a cell, which offended him. He expected better treatment, like that afforded in Germany to British prisoners of high rank. Upon hearing how close the crash site was to Glasgow, Major Donald, the assistant group officer in Glasgow, set out in his car, a Vauxhall, to locate the wreckage, telling his superiors to give the RAF a message. If they cannot catch an ME-110 with a Defiant, I am now going to pick up the bits with a Vauxhall. He found fragments of the plane strewn over an acre and a half. There was minimal fire, suggesting that when the aircraft crashed, it was almost out of fuel. The plane was indeed an ME-110 and, what's more, appeared to be brand new and looked as though it had been stripped of all excess weight. No guns, bomb racks, and surprisingly, at the time, I could find no fixed reconnaissance camera, Major Donald reported. He found a portion of the fighter's wing that bore a black cross. He put this into his car. He drove to the Giffnock police station and there found the German pilot surrounded by police officers, members of the Home Guard, and an interpreter. They did not by then appear to be making great headway, he wrote. The pilot identified himself as Hauptmann Alfred Horn, Hauptmann being the German equivalent of captain. He simply stated that he had not been hit, was in no trouble, and had landed deliberately with a vital secret message for the Duke of Hamilton, Major Donald reported, supplying the underscore. The major, who spoke rudimentary German, began asking the prisoner questions. Captain Horn was 42 and from Munich, a city Major Donald had visited. He said he hoped he had landed near the Duke of Hamilton's home and pulled out a map with the location of Dungavel House clearly marked. The airman had come remarkably close. Dungavel was only 10 miles away. Major Donald pointed out to Captain Horn that even with extra fuel tanks, the aircraft could not possibly have made it back to Germany. The prisoner said he had not planned to return and repeated that he was on a special mission. The man had a pleasant demeanor, Major Donald wrote in his report, adding, and he is, if one may apply the term to a Nazi, quite a gentleman. As they spoke, Donald studied the prisoner. Something about his face struck a chord. A few beats later, Donald realized who the man was, though his conclusion seemed too incredible to be true. I'm not expecting to be believed immediately that our prisoner is actually number 3 in the Nazi hierarchy, Major Donald wrote. He may be one of his professional doubles. Personally, I think not. The name may be Alfred Horn, but the face is the face of Rudolf Hess. Major Donald recommended that the police take very special care of the prisoner, then drove back to Glasgow, where he telephoned the headquarters of the RAF sector, commanded by the Duke of Hamilton, and told the controller on duty that the man in custody was Rudolf Hess. The message was, somewhat naturally, greeted with incredulity, according to a subsequent RAF report, but Major Donald did his best to convince the controller that he was in dead earnest, and that the Duke should be notified at the earliest moment. The Duke met the prisoner at about 10 o'clock the next morning in a room at a military hospital, to which he by now had been transferred. "I do not know if you recognize me," the German said to the Duke, "but I am Rudolf Hess." The big raid on London continued throughout the night, until the city seemed aflame from horizon to horizon. "About 5 a.m. I took a last look around," wrote Harriman's secretary, Micklejohn, "and saw the full moon shining red through the clouds of smoke which were reflecting the fires from the blazes below. It was quite a sight." That morning he shaved by the glare from the burning gas main outside. His apartment was 8 floors above the street. The last bomb fell at 5:37 a.m.